This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the only investment research platform built for fundamental investors. Think about how hard you are working to get the insights you need to make a great investment decision, how many hours you spend digging through public records and expert transcripts, or manually updating those complex models. Investors should compete on their ability to analyze investments, not how well they aggregate data. That's why Tegas offers a unified end-to-end research platform that combines robust qualitative content sets, up-to-date financial data, management and culture checks, and more, all in one easy-to-use, streamlined user experience. 95% of the top 20 global private equity firms use Tegas. Learn more and get your free trial at tegas.com/Patrick.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com.
All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
This is Matt Russell, and today we are going into the land of oil and gas to break down CNX. The history of CNX dates back over 150 years. The company's evolution has been very similar to the U.S.'s evolution when it comes to energy production. Our guest today is James Wilson, manager of the Huggin Fund at Phoenix Asset Management. We cover the CNX backstory and how they took their coal roots to build this massive natural gas business. And we discuss what differentiates CNX and its management team and its operational strategy relative to E&P peers. So please enjoy this breakdown of CNX. All right, James, excited to have you here, and I am excited to break down a commodity name. It's not one that we often cover on breakdowns, let alone in the fossil fuel space. And I was thinking about where to start with this business, and I think we could just do a short introduction on CNX, then we can get into some of the macro of the commodity itself, and then we can dive into what makes CNX different. And I know you've done a lot of research on this, so excited to get to that point. But if we could just start at the top, CNX is an E&P, exploration and production business within the energy sector, and they specifically focus on natural gas. So can you, in your best layman's terms, explain what it means to be an E&P to start us off?
I would start off in a rather confrontational manner, and I would say that actually it's more of a production company than an exploration company. In fact, almost completely a production company, because they're effectively just turning their balance sheet into cash, which is partly why I like it, but we'll get to that later. The entity that sort of started all this off is like 150, 160 years old. It started off life called Consolidated Coal, which, as it sounds, is a sort of consolidation play. It was in the Appalachian region, which is where a huge manufacturing energy production business built up, primarily because of these incredibly cheap, voluminous resources of coal that are still sitting there today, largely in place and still being used to a certain extent. As with most interesting resource plays, it went through cycle after cycle, bad management team after bad management team, levering up into the peak of the cycle and the floor of demand vanishing beneath their feet just at the wrong time, and all sorts of different ownership structures. And it just went round and round in circles. And in the sort of 60s and 70s, as everything started to be offshored and cheaper sources of energy started to be available and manufacturing went away as well, the demand reduced. And so there was this massive overhang of production. And these coal businesses, they're very long-lived assets. And in order to keep their unit costs low, they have to keep producing. You know how that ends if they keep producing into a declining demand. It's like a death spiral. So a lot of pain for the equity holders and to a certain extent the debt holders for a long period of time. And I suppose the most interesting bit to me is when the current CEO took over, which was 2013, 2014, which was after that sort of second shale bust, as it were. Another team of management, another massive amount of overinvestment, switched the management team, and this guy Nick took over. And I suppose he took a very different approach to monetizing the assets. So they've got these 4 or 5 million acres, depending how you cut it, of mineral extraction rights, which includes coal, which includes gas, which includes to a certain extent oil, although there's not a lot of oil there. And he looked at it, having worked there for 20 years previous to this, working mostly on the coal bed methane extraction process, and having followed as a part of his research the incredible productivity of particularly the Marcellus Shale when horizontal fracturing was applied to it, and thought, actually, this business is probably more valuable if we can separate the coal business off together with its very long tail liabilities, focus on the gas piece, try and put together some really serious contiguous acreage so that we can have very dense, productive local economies of scale. And then because in his view, and as has since been backed up by the operational data, the Marcellus Shale is the most productive shale in the US for natural gas, he thought maybe there's a way we can carve out a low-cost advantage. And if we've got this low-cost advantage with these vast assets, we could structure the business in such a way that it could turn it hypothetically into an annuity. Given if you assume that the natural gas demand will continue in the US for the next 20, 30, 40 years, which even the EIA suggests it will do. So I suppose that there's a long history of mostly based on coal and then lucked out by having this massive acreage and a very productive shale gas play. And then the right management took over and have restructured it. That sort of brings you up to the really interesting bit from an investment perspective.
That lays it out very well. It's a very interesting backstory here. And I think you keyed in on an interesting point there at the end, which is natural gas embedded in the assumption that they could turn this into potentially an annuity in the future with this reserve base and production profile. But they came from the world of coal, which at one point probably felt like it would never go away, but we have transitioned slowly but surely away from it, particularly in the US. Can you just compare the use case for the commodity of natural gas? What makes it interesting? What are the end use cases? Whether you want to compare it to coal, whether you want to compare it to oil, anything just in terms of the end market for natural gas and where the demand is coming from.
Natural gas is methane, the methane molecule. That's the active ingredient in what they pull out of the ground. It's just this incredibly versatile resource that's weaved its way into the fabric of our quality of life as we know it. In the US, the largest use of natural gas is in the industrial processes. And the largest part of that is fertilizer production. So ammonia production, nitrogen-based fertilizer. What we use that for, it's increasing crop yields, dramatically increasing crop yields. What we've gone from doing globally with nitrogen-based fertilizer is feeding about maybe just after World War II, which is where all the ammonia production took off because it is also used in gunpowder. So we used all that capacity to produce nitrogen-based fertilizers. And so we've gone from feeding nigh on no people with nitrogen-based fertilizers to about half the world's population. If you were to withdraw nitrogen-based fertilizers because you said natural gas was bad, you would have a large percentage of the both developed and developing world would just die. And then there'd be all sorts of civil wars about food security and stuff. So I thought that's a great starting point for underpinned to demand. And that's probably one of the reasons why we haven't withdrawn it to the extent that we have coal and so on and so forth. And then when you move into the other parts of the industrial spectrum of usage, both as a fuel and a feedstock for various chemical processes, you can see it's just right at the bottom of all sorts of really important resins, rubbers, plastics, things that go into important medical devices. It's just wonderful for localized high temperature heating of steam, which is a really important part of downstream food production, keeps the cost very low, make sure we can sterilize things properly. You're thumbing through the pages of all these textbooks which teach you about the sources and uses, and you realize if you shut this off overnight, we're going to be fighting the next war with sticks and stones very quickly. The more I got into it, the more I realized it's this incredibly versatile little molecule, and you can use it in lots of different things as we do, and it's very, very cheap. It's abundant, very easy to transport, very cheap to transport. An 18-inch gas pipeline can carry 10 times more power than the largest capacity three-phase power pipeline. So if you want to replace gas heating in homes with three-phase power, you've got to build 10 more giant grids, basically, which is very expensive and, of course, adds to the levelized cost of energy of adding in environmental or other sources. When you treat this as an engineering problem, which it isn't often treated as, you start to realize, actually, there's a great way to keep our quality of life and lower our costs of living is to use more natural gas. I suppose one of the things that you sort of wander into when you go through this kind of study, there's a real pull towards picking aside an ideology, as it were. All carbon fuels are bad, or whatever it may be. I trained as an engineer, but I sold out and became an investor. And so really, what I should be concerned about is the truth. What really works? What are the variables are we optimizing to? So we're trying to keep people alive. We're trying to keep the quality of life high. And of course, let's assume that we can have a profoundly negative effect on our climate by introducing permanent carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Just arithmetically, if you're trying to minimize the amount of carbon you emit during the transition, the right way to do that, or the only way to achieve the optimal minimum amount of carbon emitted during this transition to other sources of energy, is to very, very quickly substitute all of the fossil fuels, especially in main centralized electricity generation, substitute that for natural gas, which of course has been happening in the US. So in the US, over the last 15 years, if you add up all the carbon dioxide they've taken out of the primary energy generation from switching coal to natural gas, I think it's 5 billion tons of CO2. And then if you take all the CO2 they've taken out from switching coal to wind, solar, and nuclear combined, it's only 3 billion tons of CO2. You can see it in action. It's already occurring. It's working really well. You look at the permitting data of what's going to be built and what's going to be retired, it seems to be ongoing. The US economy, and indeed certain developed economies, are going to be increasingly reliant on natural gas because it's, from an engineering standpoint, if you want to reduce carbon, reduce costs, increase people's quality of life, it just makes sense. It seemed like there was this just very logical, rational push towards using this clean, cheap, abundant fuel in the transition, which, if you look at other energy transitions, and indeed the last 20 years of this one, is going to take us about a century. So just felt like there was a lot of really solid underpins to the demand for the product. That doesn't mean you can forecast it with any precision, but it means we need it. And if we need it, and we need it on a per capita basis, to a certain extent, within a range of outcomes, you can forecast it not going to zero tomorrow, which is the thing you're worried about as an investor.
Absolutely. There's an incredible data point in terms of coal as a percentage of US electricity generation. In the early 2000s, it was north of 50%. Today, it's less than 20%. Meanwhile, natural gas has gone from, I think, just north of 10% to close to 40%. So you have seen exactly what you described there in terms of the switching. But it begs the question of, why wasn't that always the case? What was going on in the early 2000s that caused this transition away from coal to natural gas? So what was it that unlocked the resource? And whether it was the discovery of more supply, the evolution in terms of the cost profile, what drove the secular transition away from coal and towards natural gas on the electricity side, just in general?
Far be it for me to give you some dramatically oversimplified overlay of 60, 70 years of human history, but I can give you a couple of things which I think likely contributed largely to it. We talk about what CNX is, and it's a manifestation of this wonderful new technique for extracting natural gas and oil safely from shale rock. That technology was, I think, the first horizontal well was drilled in 1947 in the US, but it was perfected by a chap called Mitchell in, I think, 97, and then Occidental bought his company, and then it all just went wild, and Chesapeake bought everything, and you can read lots of books on this stuff. This new way of extracting something, which they knew was there, but they didn't know how to get out, it became cheaper over time, and now it's very cheap on a unitized basis to get the gas out of these rocks beneath the surface of the US in various different basins, a dramatic reduction in the cost of it. The fact that it was onshore as well, you have to think that the politicians like energy security, especially when you think about that period in the 70s where they were making all these Faustian bargains with, I won't name any names, but offshore producers, to discover these super giant gas and oil fields right beneath their feet. But then also a really important, very interesting technical improvement in the centralized generation of electricity using gas, specifically in combined cycle gas turbine power plants. Wow, amazing feat of engineering. We've had these internal combustion engines on our road for decades and decades, properly in the form that we know them. And we've only really managed to get to maybe 25% efficiency. This is ignoring the mild hybrid stuff. The combined cycle gas turbine systems, the ones with the modern, very large jet engines in them, they're getting up towards 69% efficiency, which is pushing some of the limitations of thermodynamics that I can very barely remember from my university course. It's really amazing. And then when you look again from just a basic common sense perspective, they're tiny. They take up a tenth of the amount of space as a coal power plant, a hundredth of that of a nuclear power plant, and orders of magnitude less than any of the environmental sources. And land's important. Land has an impact on the environment. You don't have to clear anything for them. They're actually very mobile. You can fit some very high rated gas turbine power plants effectively onto the back of a trailer or back of two trailers. And they use them at some of the gas sites to pump the water down into the wells. So they use their own gas to extract more gas. Very high return on energy activity. And so these incredibly small, efficient, low maintenance, very reliable combined cycle gas turbines sort of exploded, for want of a better phrase, onto the scene and started replacing all the old power plants that were less than half the efficiency, as well as the coal power plants that were less than half the efficiency. And of course, when you're burning gas, it doesn't produce a load of sulfur and a load of particulate that coal does. And even with the modern production abatement techniques for coal, where they're taking out 95% of the particulate, it's that 5% that's left, which is the really fine stuff that gets into the alveoli in your lungs and screws them up and causes all sorts of stuff. And you can track the pulmonary-based diseases around US coal plants if you want to. It's very simple. And I'm surprised they haven't been decommissioned quicker, to be honest with you. So gas has a lot of the benefits of all the fossil fuels, but it has much less drawbacks than all the other possible centralized power generation techniques. So you have this much, much cheaper gas and then much, much more efficient power plants, which effectively makes it even cheaper to generate the power. And then from a capital cost perspective and a land perspective and a permitting perspective and an environmental impact perspective, it's about as low as you can get. So that explains to me in a very oversimplified way why there's been this huge adoption or substitution of natural gas in the centralized generation grid. And then obviously alongside that, when you've got this vast demand for nitrogen-based fertilizers and all the chemical precursors that they provide, it makes sense to put in the infrastructure because you've got these two important uses for it. And so there's leveraging of fixed costs and stuff.
Lay that out nicely in terms of the value chain and where you've seen this demand increase and very much connected to one another in terms of there being a feedback loop there. With CNX, you referenced the history in coal, then realizing they have this natural gas opportunity. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to be and just the acreage, the assets themselves, what that looks like? You referenced the Marcellus Basin. Can you describe where that is a little bit? Just in terms of where they're operating and how important that piece of this is for something like natural gas and the location, why it might be cheaper, anything you can add on there.
They have the gas production rights. So they separated the coal and the gas bit, which includes the assets and the liabilities. And there's an indemnification, which means they are truly legally separated, as much as anything ever can be. So they have the gas extraction rights to, on a gross basis, 5 million acres in Appalachia. So the Appalachia piece for me, or at least for them, Appalachia technically runs all the way from a bit of New York, all the way down mostly through Pennsylvania, the shallower bits that run up to Lake Erie, and then all the way down through Virginia, West Virginia, and Ohio down at the bottom end. The really deep, dense bit, the thick bit, which has the densest gas reserves and non-gas liquids reserves, which are also very valuable, is in that sort of central and southwest PA bit, which is where most of CNX's acreage is for both the Marcellus and the Utica shales. The Marcellus is about 5,000 to 6,000 feet down, and the Utica is about 10,000 to 12,000 feet down, depending on which bit of it you're in, which seems like a lot, but they just cut through it like butter nowadays. It's absolutely amazing.
It is wild to think what's down there and what's beneath. That acreage that they had the rights to, does that date back to the coal days? Did they have those rights because of something associated with the coal, or was that something that they entered into as a separate business as time went on?
I would say as of the last reserve report, probably about 40% of it came from CONSOL, which is now the listed coal entity. Nick Dulis, who's, in my opinion, is a visionary leader in the sector because he's super long-term. He is a disciple of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. He understands competitive advantage. He understands competitive advantage in the commodity industry. And he understands, perhaps most importantly, liquidity, which a lot of people don't understand in this industry, or at least perhaps I should say are not incentivized to do. He took over in this sort of bust cycle, which was very difficult. There was this overhang of the coal assets, which he floated off. There was this overhang of these production and supply contracts, which can run for many, many years, which he had to sort out, this tangled web of basically off-balance sheet leverage. And then there was actual financial leverage as well, with all its horrendous covenants and multiple debt holders who don't want the right thing for the company for the long term. Managed to sort of muddle his way through all that. And then as they chomped through maybe half of that problem, Dominion Energy was having an issue. So they managed to carve off the gas assets, the Utica and Marcellus gas assets, at least half of them of Dominion Energy, at a rock bottom price when they were on their ass, pardon my French. And no one wanted anything to do with shale gas because it was the second sort of shale bust and that was it. No private equity wanted it and all the funds were closing and stuff like that. So he understands capital allocation, especially in this type of industry. He managed to squash together the Dominion Energy assets. They weren't just a doubling of acreage. So one of the things that I learned fairly early on is the importance of local economies of scale. So you've got a huge amount of gathering and compression assets before you get to the main pipelines that you've got to put in and various other local fixed costs. And if you have loads of stranded assets all over the place, you could have millions and millions of acres, but if they're all over the place, then you've got loads of replicated fixed costs. But if you've got everything in one place, then you can leverage the same fixed costs and perhaps, I should say, capital expenditures too. So one of the beautiful things about those assets that he bought, it was right next to all the stuff that he already had. So he just increased his economies of scale, which I thought was a really smart thing to do. And not something that a lot of people appreciate. They look at these businesses and they think about the global numbers. They don't put it in the context of the local economies of scale, which is ultimately where the core unit economics are, which is what insulates you from the worst times and shows you how much money you make in the best times. So put those assets together and that sort of doubled the acreage. And then since then, they bought bits and pieces around the side so that they could effectively increase the length of their horizontal drilling, which massively increases the unitized productivity, which we can get to later as well. So yeah, I would say it was 40% inherited, and then another 40% came with this really well-timed acquisition. That's still a very difficult time for the industry with a very, very impaired balance sheet. And then bits and pieces around the side have been added and indeed sold over the years as well. So in terms of reserves, so they've got 5 million acres gross, I would say about 4 million net. They've developed about 300,000 acres, and then there's about another 100,000 acres that are proved and undeveloped. So when you look at reserve report, which talks about a sort of five-year development plan, it's really focusing on those 400,000 out of the 4 million net that they've got. And within that, they're able to report proved reserves of just shy of 9 trillion cubic feet at this incredibly low strip pricing that we've got at the moment, which is probably a very, very lower bound for what their five-year development plan could have. That's remarkable, especially considering they're producing at a sort of subsistence rate of 580 billion cubic feet. So 580 billion into your 9 trillion gives you way more than 10 years of supply just on a five-year development plan. But then that's only covering 10% of their acreage. Of course, it's not all tier one acreage. There's declining marginal returns and some of it's coal bed methane. But for my lifetime, which probably will be shorter than yours, it's absolutely acceptable as an investment where they're just turning the balance sheet into cash. That's really good sort of risk position to start in, I would say, for one of these places. And then there's other layers to it, which are in pre-risk, which is the mindset of management. I haven't talked about Will Thorndike, who wrote The Outsiders, who's a master of capital allocation, sits as the chairman of the company. And of course, you can see elements of his DNA in some of the annual letters. Nick works very closely with him.
It's a good opportunity to get into some of those unit costs and just focusing on the cost profile of this business. I imagine there's a few different ways you can do this. As you mentioned, they have these proved reserves, which have some cost to turn into natural gas that then you are selling into the market. They have unproved reserve, which probably have some additional costs. But how do you frame just the unit economics of this business? What type of methodology would you use, or how would you break it down in the easiest way possible to compare this to maybe another producer in the Marcellus region?
The way that I think about CNX's unit cost, let's be conservative and let's use a backward-looking measure for it. I know that the unit costs have improved a lot because I look at the well data that comes out, and they only drill 30 wells a year, so it's very easy to keep on top of it. But let's use a backward-looking piece, which is a very conservative way to think about it. If you look at the half cycle costs, which everyone likes to quote in their presentations because it makes things look better, but full cycle is actually how you think about it. So the half cycle cost, which is the sort of ongoing operating costs, and I think of them on a per 1,000 cubic feet of gas produced basis, so per MCF basis, which is 3 or 4% away from how they sell it, which is a British thermal unit. Let's call them equivalent for now. On a per 1,000 cubic feet of gas produced, there's about 95 cents of cost. So half cycle cost to CNX, so operating costs. So that's everything. And that includes interest, which has come down and down every year. And it actually still includes some of the contracts that the previous management signed up to in terms of rigs and resource, which has obviously been tailing off as well. It's about a 95 cents, I would say, at 580 BCF if they maintain that production rate. Interesting, one of the important parts of that 95 cents is their midstream cost. So during the sort of heady days of the production increases and the shale gas boom, a lot of the producers in Marcellus, Haynesville, everywhere else, they realized they could float off their midstream pipeline, which was the little local stuff, the stuff that has a monopoly on taking the gas from the wells, their main interstate pipelines. They realized they could float them off in a, is it master limited partnership structure? So a very tax efficient structure. And they could also stuff it with a load of debt. It was just a way of financial engineering to get more leverage in the system so they could increase production more, which gave them a higher share price. There's so many dumb things that they did. They would screw the wells over to have the highest possible initial production rates because that's how people were valuing the company. When you really push the initial production rates too high, you massively reduce the total ultimate recovery of the well and destroy the IRRs.
Release the choke, let it blow out.
It's scandalous. This is what happens in bubbles. Anyway, so they were spinning off these midstream assets, and indeed, CNX management did it because they had a lot of debt and they needed more debt. So one of the smart things that Nick did from an M&A perspective is when the price of the midstream assets was cheap, he bought it back in. Now, what that does is it removes the off-balance sheet leverage of minimum production levels, normally growing production levels that you have to deliver to the midstream. And if you can't deliver it, you have to buy it off someone else, or you just have to overpay to deliver it yourself. Really terrible issues it's caused, and studied other Marcellus producers who did this and had to sell overriding royalties to fund the minimum production levels. Oh, terrible long-term impairment of value. So they bought those back in. And what that means is, as part of their cost structure, they don't have this monopoly sitting between the gas production and the interstate pipelines that get a massive cut of the economics, a huge economic rent. And so if you look at their midstream costs, they're like half of everyone else's, 50, 60 cents per MCF. And that's a huge component of their cost advantage, really is. And then you look at the other ones now, everyone's realized that these midstream assets have got a monopoly type nature and they like the dividend income from it. And quite often, I won't name any names, but management would be managing the production and the midstream assets. They'd float the midstream assets, put themselves in a CEO, pay themselves a second salary and a second bonus and a second LTIP package. And you'd see that if some of them actually just move profits between the production and the midstream assets, pay themselves these huge bonuses every year. It's not for me to judge people. I'm sure there's something I'm missing.
I'll defend the tax advantage of the master limited partnership on an isolated basis. Makes those assets potentially worth more in that vehicle, but it did attract a lot of bad actors. Beyond that initial value addition, I would agree that it tended to get out of control there, for sure.
This is the beautiful thing about markets, isn't it? You get to have a little look at everything and pick the ones you like, pick the ones you don't. And of course, I could be wrong. So they've got their own midstream assets, which is a really important part of their cost advantage. Keeps it very, very, very low. Below a dollar, I would say, for the operating costs. Now, because they built out a lot of their midstream and gathering infrastructure and compression infrastructure for the next 5 or 6 years, I would say, when you think about the CapEx, it's really about drilling and completion. So it's about finding where they want to drill, drilling it, completing it, and connecting it up, turning it in line, as I think they say in the industry. So that drilling and completion, a CapEx, comes to, this is backward looking, so it's better now, but it's backward looking, comes to, I would say, about maybe 45 cents per MCF. If you divide it over the total recovery of the well. And I do that on a very conservative basis. A lot of them will do it over 30, 40 years. I do it over 20, 25 years, depending on what the well looks like. So there's quite a lot of elements of conservatism built into the way that I think about the unit economics. So let's call that an all-in cash cost, full cycle, to maintain production levels at 580 BCF for CNX at 140 in today's money. Now, they can sell it in the market, or they have been selling it in the market at $2.50 over the last few years. And actually, I think that's around that area is a relatively reasonable clearing price for the marginal producer in the US, $3.50, maybe $4 to keep supply online. I certainly think there's upward pressure on that because the marginal wells are actually less productive in the marginal producers. That's a whole other tangent to go off on. It's an extraordinarily low gas price. In the UK, Europe, it's five times that. And we're actually thankful for those prices. One of the wonderful things about investing in the US, apart from the property rights, which are second to none globally, when you own a property, you own the mineral rights, and it's up to you who you sell them onto or let produce them or sell a royalty or whatever. It's not like that in the UK. The Crown owns it and loads of other places. It's a disaster for private shareholders. But in the US, it's wonderful. I love it. I hope it never changes. And there's a lot of legal precedent to protect it. So long may it live. The other wonderful thing about extraction business in the US, gas extraction business, is it costs more to bring natural gas into the US on a liquefied, this is not a pipeline. No one's built a transatlantic or transpacific pipeline yet, but it costs more on a per MCF basis to liquefy it down from, let's say, the South Pars field, which is one of the cheapest places to get it in the world, and bring it over to the US than it does to just consume it. You're talking about $4 per MCF, best case scenario, for liquefying it down, but you can buy it for three wholesale in the US, and there's an abundance of it, and you can buy as much as you want. So it's this wonderful sealed microcosm of supply and demand, where all the shale basins have been explored. They've all been drilled to hell. We all know who the best operators are. We all know who's got the best acreage. And we all know who's got the most drilling locations left. And we know that the only competition really comes from the Montney shale in Canada, but they haven't got the pipelines to do it.
I think you covered the unit economics well there, just in terms of all-in cost. If I were to separate and compare it relative to another operator in the Marcellus, Southwestern, I'm not sure exactly who's still operating there, and large, Cabot, EQT. I think you mentioned the transportation cost was probably one of the biggest differentiators between CNX and those competitors. And I think you mentioned it could be upwards of double that 50 to 60 cents that it costs them, which is a large percentage of the overall production cost. Is that right? As that's a key differentiator just in terms of making them one of the most cost advantage producers?
As you might expect, I've studied a lot of these. You've got to get the competitive battlefield to start saying, well, these guys are very close to the bottom left-hand corner of the cost curve. So I would say, on my calculations, because you have to do your own work here, you have to cut gross CapEx for maintenance CapEx, you have to figure out what they're capitalizing, which is actually OpEx, you have to figure out what the future costs are going to be, because they aren't necessarily what they're going to be in the past in terms of the contracts they've signed with the midstream. I would say EQT is probably second after CNX. And that's, again, primarily because the Rice brothers came back in with the support of DE Shaw and another hedge fund, cut all the unnecessary costs out, focused on drilling the most productive acreage, and renegotiated with the midstream for a much, much lower cost. But they still have to give over an economic rent, so it is still much higher. And then Range Resources is also very good as well, but still much higher transportation costs. If you also remove those, there's a sort of engineering excellence at CNX, which is a sort of overlay. But of course, it's not as big an advantage as the rest of it. It's not just the engineering excellence. They've actually got a new COO, Navneet, who I spent a day in the field with, who's one of the most brilliant brains I've ever encountered in my life. Just incredible breadth, successful entrepreneur in his own right. Lives in Texas, but wanted to come and drill this acreage because it's so much fun. They've got this really amazing engineering culture. It's produced this sort of tiny little marginal improvements, which over time have produced this wonderful embedded industrial knowledge, which has led to 5% here, 10% there, which all adds up and gives them an extra layer of insulation. The drilling, from what I can see, is getting more and more productive. They're drilling longer and longer laterals. And the real kicker, they're starting to make the Utica extraordinarily productive and extraordinarily economic. There's a well pad, Morris 40, which other people can look up for CNX. They drilled a 21,000 foot lateral in the Marcellus, and it peaked out at, I don't know, 600,000 MCF for a month. That was the peak production. And they drilled a 16,000 foot lateral Utica right next to it, which is obviously much less and it should be less productive. It was just as productive as the Marcellus. So they're starting to commercialize the Utica, which sits right below the Marcellus. So they've got all this gathering and transportation infrastructure sitting above it. They've got all the water they need. They've got their own water infrastructure as well, which is part of their cost advantage, bringing stuff in-house when you know what your production is going to be. And then they've got this stacked plate. So they can start drilling this extra acreage, which they have the rights to, with all the infrastructure above them. So what does that mean for the marginal return on capital? It's absolutely massive. It's all sitting there. They've told people about it on the conference call, but I suppose maybe people don't care about the long term as much as I do, but it's just very interesting.
These stack plays, I think, are hard to overstate in terms of the value, because you could put a price on a per acreage basis, but when you're considering that you're basically drilling into two layers of rock rather than just one layer, it makes any one specific metric hard to view as the end all be all. And it really does require a combination of all these things together. You referenced before the drilling dynamics, the capital requirements that go into this for proving out the acreage, proving out the reserves. And while that gets allocated over the life of the well, I imagine most of those dollars are spent up front, particularly with drilling out the well. So how do you think about those cash flow dynamics when it comes to one of these businesses and getting comfortable with whether it's that cash has already been spent or there's something else going on there? Because it is somewhat of a mismatch in terms of it's not the Berkshire insurance float, which brings a lot of the cash in the door, and then you get to spread it out over many years. How do you think about that when it comes to being a producer?
All the private equity playbooks for measuring return on investment and stuff. So when I think about a business, I always shrink it down to what's the unit cost? You can separate the central stuff, which is normally not that big. If it was a retailer, I want to know what your sales per square foot, what's your property cost, all that stuff. When you put down another store, are you actually making money on an economic basis or are you just pushing your EPS up on an accounting basis? So if you look at the individual wells, because I've got 2,700 wells worth of data that I can go through and I can figure out in all sorts of different areas. If you get the average one, again, backward looking, not the newer one, so it's conservative. You can do IRRs, you can do paybacks. Your paybacks are less than 2 years. This is backward looking wells. You can do scenarioization at different strip pricing with really aggressive assumptions on basis, which is the cost that they need to give away to the bigger pipelines. And I would say at 250 net back gas pricing, they're making in excess of 40% IRRs. Absolutely astounding returns on capital. When I study businesses, my sort of rough hurdle for something, I want it to be able to earn a 15% return on its capital unlevered. That normally suggests to me that it's got some sort of competitive advantage. Sometimes I'll find businesses that can do 20. Rarely will I find a business that can do a 30, normally a pharmaceutical company with a patent that's got 20 years left to run or whatever. 40% sustainable IRRs on capital are amazing and something to be thoroughly studied to make sure they're not a fraud, basically, when you find them. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out ways that this was a fraud and haven't found one yet. And it all comes back to that wonderful non-replicable acreage, the amazing engineering focus, the understanding of local economies of scale, and the lack of leverage and lack of outsourcing of things like water, gathering, and transportation infrastructure.
We haven't talked about another key variable in that equation, which is the price of natural gas and what they're earning there. And I could make the argument if they're getting 40% returns, you could push the pace even further, even if it means that you're bringing down the price slightly and getting 35%, 30% IRRs because of a lower price. So how do they manage the volatility that occurs in commodity markets and natural gas markets? And how do you frame that as an investor?
Well, it's a very, very interesting sort of intellectual conversation. Risk and uncertainty, they're bridging the gap between those two. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, they're the lowest cost producer of natural gas in the US. If that's the case, And the marginal producer, which is where it's going to fluctuate rationally, logically, not rationally, there's nothing rational about these markets. In the short term, that is. In the long term, there needs to be. But if it's going to fluctuate around 3, 350, whatever it might be, then if you're the lowest cost producer with full cycle unit costs at 140 and half cycle less than a dollar, then why would you need to hedge? You don't need to hedge because you're profitable at all points in the cycle. Even now, people are struggling for oxygen at 150 gas, the ones that haven't hedged. Cancelling dividends, cancelling drilling contracts, shutting in wells, all that kind of stuff. CNX doesn't care because they're generating cash profits at all points in the cycle, even these kind of low points. Their cost structure makes them incredibly de-risked. It means they survive, not only survive, but do okay in the bad times, and then they do extraordinarily well in the good times. However, because Nick and the board, and indeed the whole company, have studied Buffett, what it means to compound over a long period of time is that the key to that is survival, right? And so you'd want to put survival not just as likely, you want to put it beyond all doubt. And so even though they have this incredible low cost structure, they have the most comprehensive hedging schedule. It swaps as well, which is the thing that everyone avoids because it's slightly more expensive, I would say, instead of these collars and they try and hedge it out, which I'm not sure are actually zero cost collars. The bankers never walk away without money in their pockets.
And when they go down, there's a very expensive cost when you break through the collar, which was learned for a few producers.
They've got these swaps, which are dead simple, maybe a little bit more expensive, but they're very clear. There's very little counterparty risk in this incredibly liquid market, and they hedge out. I think their farthest one is 5.5 years. So they've got this stepped hedging schedule. So they always go into the next year slightly more than 90% hedged. And then it steps down. And then by the time you get to year 5 or 6, it's down at sort of 10, 20%. And so really for CNX, the important thing is not the spot pricing, which fluctuates wildly. It's the strip pricing, which you can get by looking at the NYMEX Henry Hub piece every day, which is normally at a slight premium over the long term to those spot prices. And so you've got this incredibly low cost production base, this massive contiguous acreage, not had a dry well in years. It's just, where do we drill next? Where's the most productive well as opposed to where's the next well? Very predictable drilling schedule, lots and lots of inventory, a really solid balance sheet, which we haven't talked about. They've just kicked off the nearest maturity, another 5 years. So your average maturity is out by 7 or 8 years. Most of it's now in 2030s. And then you've got this demand profile. There's always going to be some demand there. It fluctuates 5 to 10% and the price fluctuates a lot. But you're hedged. You know what you're going to produce, what your costs are going to be, what you're going to get for it. So they've turned this incredibly, what people would consider on the outside to be this disaster of value destruction and volatility and leverage, they've turned it from that, which is what it used to be, into this annuity. It's absolutely remarkable. I've never seen anything like it. But it all comes back to sensible management, sensible use of leverage and liquidity, which is coming down, and indeed the core jewel in the crown, which is the non-replicable acreage, the engineering excellence, the low cost. It all starts from there.
You mentioned the annuity, I think, of something that's flat. Does the production profile, is there growth in terms of how much they're producing from year to year? Or are they really moderate about how they're actually growing production? I am wondering how much they think about that end market and if there is big demand, if the strip pricing goes up and they can produce more because they're able to hedge it out. Is that something they tend to react to?
They don't at the moment. I would say because of that incredibly risk averse, we want to survive forever type mentality. They've got, I would say, internal targets about where they want leverage to get to. To be honest with you, there's also limitations on transportation in the area. Because if you look at Henry Hub is in Louisiana, right? Which is where there was a ton of transportation infrastructure to start with. So if you look at Haynesville producers, they have very cheap transport because there's loads of pipelines. In the Marcellus coal producing region, it was railroads. So you can't really produce transport gas effectively through railroads. So there is actually a limitation to the amount of gas that can transport there. And I would say we've now got to a point where there's been consolidation and a relatively sensible amount of production growth where the pipelines are full. So as you said, there's this really interesting balance between if we're the lowest cost, why don't we just hammer a load more volume in there? Because net will likely get more profits quicker out of the gas we own. But I would say the place the business is at, most of the management teams would probably be doing that. It's a sort of prisoner's dilemma type problem, isn't it? But because they want to survive, and perhaps because they're waiting for a different administration that might want to drill, that might want to build pipelines, maybe they're not doing it yet. The Mountain Valley Pipeline, which EQT had a piece of, I think that's now been approved again and is being built and will be completed hopefully this year. But that's really all that's been done in Appalachia. There's not much takeaway capacity, as they call it. And I suppose CNX are very cautious, very measured. They believe, and as I do, that what they have beneath the surface of the earth there is incredibly valuable. And they're trying to maximize the NPV for shareholders. And sometimes that may mean deferred gratification to avoid the risk of ruin, which is really smart when you consider the base rate of unsuccessful companies in this business. This is not normal for me to to be looking at these type of businesses. I want to buy things at less than liquidation value that people are going to need for a long period of time. And I never thought I'd think of this kind of business as that. But the management team have created something special, I would say.
On the point of takeaway capacity and the transportation and the pipelines, once you get beyond the gathering and processing pipes, how much competition is there for that takeaway capacity? Do they have to pay higher rates just to keep the same amount of capacity on those pipelines leaving the market? Is there anything unique about that? And then to your point, is there more coming to the region? How much of a risk is that or a potential benefit? It does seem like transportation is a key piece to this. I'm curious about how much that swings from year to year.
One of the points about this investment is when I speak to people about it, I get lots of interesting reactions. Probably 60% of it is about ideology, and they say, you're part of our club. And I say, no, I don't like being part of clubs. I just like good investments. But maybe the other 40% is they go, yeah, and there's going to be loads of LNG capacity, and there's going to be loads of new pipelines, and solar and wind don't work, so we're going to need more gas, and gas price is going to be $10 before you know it. I don't get into all that. I don't like a lot of forecasting and a lot of Panglossian thinking. When I buy an investment, I want it really to make sense at the worst case scenario, which is really what we've been rumbling along for the last 5 or 6 years in the gas markets. It's just horrendously low prices globally, unseen before in history on a real basis, and massive constraints in pipeline, particularly in that Appalachian region, because they've had to build a lot of pipeline quite quickly because they didn't have the existing stuff for it. So you've got this, to the extent that the pipeline operators can monetize their investment, they are doing so maximally at the moment. And it's costing CNX, who hedge their basis, by the way, it's a very important part of what they do because of that. And sometimes they buy it forward when it makes sense to do so on a countercyclical basis. But that's costing them, I don't know, 50, 60 cents at the moment, which is much, much more than, like I said, Haynesville, where they've got abundant pipeline. But one of the things that I go back to is a lot of people who think about this industry, they've hopefully studied Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller and what happened there. And one of the things you see when you study the regulation in this industry, especially with the national transportation stuff, the stuff that crosses state lines, is it's just peppered with anti-monopolistic regulation. And whenever something crops up that looks anything like the Standard Oil monopoly control and influence positions, then there's always a pushback on you're charging too much economic rent. So I suppose one of the things I was worried about with these investments was the midstream bit. It seemed to me that was the Achilles heel, because they are much less regulated than the ones that cross state boundaries. But the ones that cross state boundaries, which is where the main bottleneck is for Appalachian gas, they're heavily regulated and have been so with loads of legal precedent since the breakup of Standard Oil. So that I'm less worried about. And it does screw customers over when they start screwing people over, because that cost pass-through just goes straight into the gas prices. So I'm less worried about that. I think the monopolistic invisible hand, as it were, has been kept out of that for a very long period of time, and I don't see that changing. Could be wrong, of course, could be wrong, but it seems unlikely.
You've touched on leverage and how they manage the balance sheet a few times. It was obviously an issue for many of the producers in several of the shale booms, where too much leverage caught up to them in a bad commodity cycle and caused ruins. How do they approach the balance sheet? Are there target leverage ratios or anything else unique that they do with the balance sheet?
They have covenants, which they're miles away from. It's interesting with them because their P&L makes no sense at all, because they've got all these tax losses and stuff. There's no issues with covenants because of the way they hedge what the cash profit is going to be, which ultimately affects the leverage piece. They've got it to the extent now where they can buy back shares, which is really where most of the cash has been going. So they managed to buy back more than a third of their equity over the last 2.5-3 years, which is a really interesting capital allocation piece. And if you think it's good value now, how much more value is it when half the shares have gone missing over the next 2 years? So leverage is an issue. But with leverage, it's all about structure, isn't it? So they've just actually, as of today, refinanced their 2027 bond, kicked it off to, I think, 2032. Might be a bit longer than that. But they also keep an undrawn revolver, which could cover more than the next 5 years of maturities. So there's just this massive amount of liquidity there. But then they also have enormous liquidity in their cost structure. They only have one drilling rig, which is not on some gigantic long-term contract, and one completions crew. And their half-cycle cash costs are 95 cents. So their EBITDAX, before they put anything back into the ground, is about $1 billion. And their next debt maturity is $200 million, which is in 2026. But they've got this abundant undrawn revolver, which is many times what they'll ever need in any worst case scenario. And then they've got this massive amount of play on their cash margins as well. And they've got a hedge book, so you know what they're going to get for the gas. So there's just layers and layers of conservatism in there, because it's all with this really wonderful principle of, we don't want to make survival likely, we want to put it beyond all doubt. And that's what I absolutely love here.
And I assume you have other producers in the region, which maybe aren't operated as cleanly, might have challenges. Is acquisitions, or whether it's full businesses or a certain amount of acreage, is that a piece of the story here as well? How much are they adding to the reserve base, not in an organic way of just developing what they already have leased, but in acquiring stakes or businesses elsewhere? And if it hasn't happened yet, do you think that's a possibility in the future?
I think it's a very small part of what they spend their time on. I think they are, in the words of the late great Sam Zell, who died last year, they are professional opportunists. So they have abundant liquidity, which provides an insulation from some of the unknown unknowns and the vicissitudes that happen in this sector. But it also provides you with capital when no one has none. That has proved to be a very valuable thing to have, that option to buy stuff when you need to. But I would say they plan along the lines of organic development of the land they've got. And when you look at the reserve report, they're adding to proved, developed, producing reserves just organically. Whilst they're drawing down on them, they're adding to them quicker than they're drawing down on them. So you've got this same production profile and this really steady capital cost, but they just keep stacking up the producing reserve more and more. That reserve report as well, for SEC rules, it's restricted to a certain five-year window of what they've sent the independent engineers to go and look at. So I would say they've got, coming back to my original point that they're not an E&P company, they're a P company, means that they don't have to really worry too much about the complexities of buying other businesses. But I think they're smart capital allocators. They understand that price is what you pay, value is what you get. And sometimes, maybe once every 5 or 10 years, you get a real fat pitch and you've got to swing when you get it. But I would say it's not part of the everyday thinking. When I spoke to them about land acquisition, it's really, in a very refreshing way, all about unitized productivity. So you speak to them and they say, well, really what happens is we get on site and we figure out that we could take these three wells an extra 5,000 feet. If we just had that extra 3 acres. So then they give it to the landmen and they say, can we just have these extra 3 acres? And then that trebles the IRR of the well. That kind of thing. It's just smart. And actually, that land is of no use to anybody else because no one's got any gathering or transportation infrastructure in the area. No one's got any wells in the area. It's only really valuable to CNX. It means they can get a really low price for it, which is part of why they get the higher IRR. So it's very, very selective and opportunistic on that side as well.
It sounds like the income statement has a lot of unique things in it, which might make earnings a challenging thing to use as a valuation profiler. They require a lot of adjustments, but how do you even approach this from a valuation standpoint, whether it's looking at the reserve base, looking at the earnings or cash flow profile? How do you approach this one?
It's all about the decline rate of the existing wells and the production and indeed decline rates of the new wells. You can never pinpoint the value of something, right? You can only come up with a range of values. Let's just take somewhere in the middle of the range of what I think is going to happen. I think that if things continue as they are, which is the US gas market bumbling along the bottom of what is the worst ever time in history for it, if that continues, they'll just continue with this subsistence production profile of 580 BCF, plus or minus 10% if they slow things down, if there's bad weather or if it's too cold or whatever. These things happen. So if you've got 580 BCF, what you get over time is over the next year, the capital intensity, they're going to have built out all their midstream and processing and pipeline capacity that they need for their production profile. So the CapEx is going to drop off 20% or so. And then at the same time, you've got to think about the mature wells. They're in hyperbolic decline. Every year you go through, you have to bring less wells online or less production online to keep your production stable. So not only do you get this long-term CapEx piece that drops out, but the capital intensity falls off as well to maintain the same production. But at the same time, your proved, developed, producing gas reserves profile keeps going up. And then, of course, you've got to layer on top of that stacked play, the Utica, which they're only just starting to touch, which, as I explained before, leads to very, very high marginal returns on capital. So in my mind, you've got this wonderful three or four tailwinds, which mean the marginal return on capital from an already wonderful starting point of 40% or something, better and better and better. And it gets easier and easier and easier, or lower capital intensity, to maintain the production at 580 BCF, which is not much work for them because it's, well, it's a lot of work because they do it well, but it's one drilling rig and one completion crew. So I sort of think of them bumbling on this really subsistence level of production of this sort of vast resources they've got with a lower and lower capital intensity, just because of the simple arithmetic reality of the decline rate in the wells they've got.
What stand out as the main risks?
The main risks really come from, for me, human intervention. So you've already seen what the issue with pipeline capacity has done to the gas price in the region and the cost of transporting the gas. So that's, as usual, government intervention has produced a suboptimal outcome for a lot of consumers and a lot of business owners and a lot of equity and debt holders. And of course, the US government is a very powerful, very wealthy organization, and they can do unsustainable things for long periods of time, they can outlast me and my investors. So if they say, actually, there's some ginormous carbon tax, which is perhaps not within two standard deviations of what I think could happen, but it's a tail risk here that could make 40% IRR into a 10% or a 5% IRR quite quickly. The main pieces come from the sort of curveballs of human intervention. Whenever I examine the nuts and bolts of what we need and how we live and how we maintain our quality of life and all these really, in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the very bottom layer, how we keep that solid, I think the demand profile for natural gas is great and the position that CNX occupies in the lowest cost country in the world is really solid. It's more the overlay, the regulation and the way that humans can get involved for myopic political reasons. I have no control over that. Nobody knows how it's going to play out. And I've been very surprised at the extent to which the amount of money for length of time, money has disappeared into various things that didn't make any economic sense to start with, let alone now where things have changed. As always, the issue is humans.
Very well said. And it dovetails nicely into our closing question, which is lessons. And oftentimes these lessons say something about the humans managing the business or something along those lines. But what do you think the key lessons are for you as an investor that you might be able to apply elsewhere when you think about CNX?
Well, I can give some sort of quite broad pieces. I suppose they come from pushback when I speak to prospective investors or current investors. Is this idea that cyclicality is a bad thing? It's a very myopic way to think. So if you imagine there are certain types of product where sometimes it's difficult to discern cyclicality from structural decline. But if you know there's a really solid relationship between per capita demand and GDP per capita in a country or whatever it might be, there's this really solid relationship going back over a period of time. You can pull it apart and you can understand that actually, yeah, we need to heat our homes when it's cold and we need to cook our meals so that they don't make us ill. And we need to fertilize our crops. So our yields are two or three times what they were without. When you pull something down and you see this wonderful, solid and growing demand base for something, then the noise of cyclicality shouldn't really mean anything to you. It's exactly that noise. And if other people see that noise as signal and act upon it like it's some sort of thing to be extrapolated, that gives you opportunity. So volatility is not risk if your business is structured in the right way and your investment is priced correctly. It's actually opportunity. When I speak to some people about this particular investment, and I've got a lot of other cyclical business that have proved themselves to be wonderful over long periods of time, I say there's a difference between volatility and risk if it's handled correctly. And actually, if you're truly long-term and you can understand the demand drivers of a business, then volatility and cyclicality, I should say, can be opportunity for you. But you've got to do your homework.
I love that. That's a new lesson, but I think it's perfect. And we switch back between businesses with recurring revenue streams into the most cyclical of industries, into commodity industries, which are obviously cyclical, but they bring their own issues. So this has been fun. I love that wisdom to close it out. It's been an absolute pleasure, James. Thank you for joining us here.
No worries. I've enjoyed it.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's JOINCOLOSSUS.com.
A quick note before you go. If you are a company hiring or a candidate looking for your next opportunity, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting. We launched our recruiting efforts at the end of last year. We started working with firms that were interested in tapping into our audience. And after seeing some early success, we want to open this up to additional firms and to candidates who are proactively looking for their next opportunity. So we are mostly revolving around the investment world and the tech industry. But again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting for more information.